All right, we're back on the record, so Mr. McCullough.
Great, thank you. We'll keep this prompt. Mr. Englund, you were testifying in response to questions from Ms. Baxendale about types of vessels and whether they were cargo vessels or not. You recall that?
Yes.
But then I think, and I don't want there to be confusion here, I was trying to track that. You were also testifying about activity being conducted on a vessel.
Yes.
So was it your testimony that a vessel could appear to be, I think you mentioned a container ship, for example, a cargo vessel, but perhaps not be engaged in cargo activity?
Yes.
And I assume that's vice versa?
Correct.
Yeah. So do you have an example of such a container ship?
Well, like the Hanjin Copenhagen, when they went to T5, they weren't conducting any cargo operations.
They usually board T-46?
Correct. They call in the T-46, which is referred to sometimes as the Hanjin Terminal. That's where they have a lease for it. Total Terminals is the terminal operator. And so they shifted from Terminal 46 to Terminal 5. They were not conducting cargo operations. Or you can look at Terminal 25, where there's a Masson ship that's been moored there for some time, and they're not conducting any for, I think, almost a couple of years, and they're not conducting any cargo operations per se.
What are they doing?
This is labor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, idle moorage otherwise.
Idle moorage.
Right. So what was the Copenhagen doing over on T5?
Copenhagen was responding to a captain of the port order to make sure that they did conduct some repairs and an inspection of the ship by the Coast Guard before they left.
Mm-hmm. Was that a discretionary? Was their response to that discretionary?
No.
Oh.
Absolutely not.
Okay. Was that something that was likely to occur at the cargo at Terminal 46?
It had already occurred before.
The repairs, excuse me.
No, they couldn't conduct at 46 because there was other cargo operations that were going to need to take place. So we shifted the vessel over to another terminal.
Okay. Now, in response to questions from Mr. Baca, I think he asked whether, and I may not get this quite right, so, but that could you imagine any vessel that could not moor at Terminal 91?
No.
And your answer was no.
No, we're obligated to moor vessels if they call us and they're looking for moorage in the harbor. That's part of our mission, and that's the Maritime Commission. We're regulated, and so if someone calls up and they need moorage, we're obligated to try to accommodate them. Mm-hmm.
So you were trying to comply with your federal law obligations.
Correct.
But in answering that question, are you answering it in complete disregard of local regulations, or because you think that it is an allowable use?
No, it's an allowable use. It's been historically allowable. All those have been allowable uses out at the terminal, at any of those terminals. And it's been common practice before I got out there, and I just continue on with what's been acceptable practice for decades.
And this practice you're describing is, again, it's idle moorage or labor thing?
Yes.
In this example. And do you believe that that is within the scope of allowable cargo terminal operations under your existing permit?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You were also asked about whether you could imagine that there were any limits on kinds of activities that could be conducted on the upland portion of the terminal, and I think your answer was no.
No.
Now, just to be clear for the record, does that mean that if I wanted to build an apartment building on Terminal 91, I could do that? Or an arena?
No. No, there are sideboards, obviously.
Would that be within the limits of the cargo terminal and other permitted uses?
To build an arena?
No. I mean, you had said no, there were no limits, and I'll let you clarify.
Okay, yes. No, there's limits to what you can do out on a cargo terminal.
Mm-hmm.
You can't.
Are those limits related to your permitted uses?
Yes.
Then finally, you would testify, I think you were asked the question about a cruise ship, whether a cruise ship that came into the harbor could moor at Terminal 5.
Correct.
And your answer was?
No. Well, could a cruise ship can moor over at Terminal 5, for
okay.
sure.
Right. So, and that is because it would be
an acceptable use.
So presumably, now when was the, there is a permit for cruise ship facility at Terminal 91, is that right?
Yes.
And has that been there for 100 years? I mean, the permit?
No.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you to open up the FOSS exhibits to FOSS Exhibit 89. So you see the book there that... And you see, this is a City of Seattle analysis and decision of the director of DPD.
Uh-huh, yes.
And the I won't ask you to read it, but just looking at the summary of the proposed action, you could just paraphrase. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's wait for the examiner. You could just paraphrase what this permit is for.
This permit is basically for the construction of a passenger facility at Terminal 91. Mm-hmm.
And looking at the last page and the date of it, it was dated very end.
June 7, 2007.
Mm-hmm. So your testimony was that a cruise ship could moor today at Terminal 5.
Yes.
Is that right? So presumably, if that's the case, then cruise ships should have been able to moor at Terminal 91 prior to 2007.
Yes.
So I'm going to ask you to turn to page 2 of this permit and look at the first paragraph under the section Project Background.
Yes.
And ask you to read the last sentence.
While cruise ships have moored at T90 in the past and may continue to do so, there has not been a home port passenger terminal located at the pier.
So is this consistent with your testimony about the availability of Terminal 5, for example, for such idle moorage?
Yes.
I don't have anything further.
All right. Is there anything in the fleet to discuss? Some follow-up questions, because there's a break in between.
You may cross-examine him on the redirect. I hope it will be brief.
Mr. Eglin, you testified earlier that you didn't know what permits there were for any of the port's facilities other than cargo terminal and passenger terminal. Is that right?
Yes.
So when,
by the port.
So when you were asked just now that whether there were any sideboards on the permits, you said that all the on the activities, you said that all the activities had to be consistent with all of the permits.
Objection. Right? Misstates his testimony. Testified all the permits have to be related to their permit uses.
Rephrase the question rather than going through and retrieving.
You also testified that, I'll come back to that. You testified that all of the uses that were carried on at Terminal 5 were all allowable, at Terminal 91 were all allowable uses. And you don't know what the permits are. That there were no limits on the uplink activities other than what would be consistent with the permits of Terminal 91.
Again, misstates his testimony. He did not say that in his redirect. He said all the permits have to be related to the permitted uses.
Oh, they don't have to be consistent with, they just have to be related to. Is that correct?
That's what I said.
What?
The permits have to be related to whatever the permitted uses are. But I'm not an expert on the permits. I haven't gone over all the permits for Terminal 91. But I just understand that it's a cargo terminal permit and it's a passenger bus.
And so, what's the difference to you between the related to and consistent with?
No difference to me necessarily. It's just you're talking about kind of wordsmithing. Really sure what you're. I wouldn't necessarily differentiate between the two.
So when you say that something is limited to its permitted purpose, do I understand you correctly then that you believe that having a cargo terminal permit allows the port to provide berthing at any of its facilities without regard to what kind of a vessel it is, except perhaps for passenger terminals? Is that correct?
I would say maybe not even with regard to passenger terminals. I'm not really sure why the passenger terminal was called out, because we had already conducted and conducting for years cruise operations with passengers at terminals. But I think my understanding was that permit was to construct that passenger terminal facility in the building itself, and it was on that, because we'd already been conducting cruise operations at the terminal. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Thank you. I have a couple of recross.
I would really like for this to be brief. I think it's pretty clear Mr. M. Lynn has made, if it's going to be more permitting related questions, is that what I'm sensing? Okay.
I would like to just point out inconsistency between earlier.
All right.
Earlier I asked you, and I'll read from my notes here. In your view, are there any limitations on the types of vessels that could moor at Terminal 91? Based on its shoreline permits? And you said no. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Now, in response to Mr. McCullough's question just now, you said something to the effect of there are limits related to the permitted uses. Is that correct?
Yes.
So how do you square those two answers?
Well, you're not allowed to, like, build residential facilities on the terminal. So there's all sorts of limits that we don't go into residential, because this comes up all the time. A lot of people worry that we're going to redevelop it potentially for a residential terminal, for instance, or convert it. So that's usually the context. And so there are limits for redevelopment at the terminal. We would have to go get a permit for that.
So how about for moorage? Are there limits related to moorage?
I don't really see any limits in terms of the moorage, no.
Thank you. No further questions.
All right, and at the risk of hogging this some more, Mr. Englund, you were saying you can't build a house. You were telling Mr. McCullough the various upland uses that you didn't think would be allowed. What's that based on? What is your understanding of what is allowed and not allowed based on?
So when we looked at redeveloping the terminal and all the dialogue that I've heard, in terms of the permitting, we're not going to convert anything over to any kind of residential use. It's not allowed. So there was a big concern at 91 in the uplands, for instance.
So when you say it's not allowed, this is just what are you basing that on?
I was basing it upon redevelopment dialogue.
Within the Port of Seattle sort of management? Is that what you just understood from other employees there?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just trying to figure out what your base of knowledge was for the statement. So,
ongoing, dialogue, and we're not going to redevelop the condominiums, and that was articulated to the neighborhoods and the public, is what I understood.
All right. Thanks. Okay. I think we could get started with your next witness, then, Mr. Schein.
Thank you, Mr. England. Mike McLaughlin, please.
Laughlin, I'll swear you in. If you could raise your right hand, do you swear or affirm that the testimony you'll present is true? If so, say, I do.
I do.
You're a witness.
Would you spell your last name for us, please?
McLaughlin.
What's your position?
My title position is Director of Cruise and Maritime Operations.
For the Port of Seattle?
Yes, the Maritime Division.
Before I ask you about your job responsibilities, I'd like to go into your background with the Port of Seattle. First of all, how long have you been with the port?
I started working for the port in June of 1985, just finished my 30 years.
And can you start at the beginning and go through those 30 years and summarize the different jobs you've had with the Port of Seattle?
Sure. So in 1985, I started working in the maintenance department, which was primarily made up of all the multi-crafts, union craft workers that maintained all the physical assets for the Port of Seattle in the Maritime Division. I came in as a represented worker, and after a few years, then I moved into a supervisory role, and to the point where I was superintendent of buildings and grounds, responsible for the maintenance of all the assets within the Marine Division.
And so can you give us an overview of the assets for which you were responsible?
So in the Maritime Division, our assets are primarily a lot of the facilities we've been discussing over the last couple of days here, all the marine terminals, the upland areas that are adjacent to or supportive of the berthing areas for the vessels, some industrial properties that were tied to public access sites that may have been developed for a permitting action, parks, and some buildings that were more industrial properties, and also inclusive of Shoshone Bay Marina, the recreational facility in Ballard, and Fisherman's Terminal, which is the home for the smaller fishing fleet that's served out of that facility.
How many years were you responsible for managing all these assets?
I worked in marine maintenance from 1985 to around, I don't think exactly the date, 97, I believe, with 96, 97. I went back to school and finished the executive management program at the University of Washington, and then from that point pursued other opportunities in the Port of Seattle within the project management group.
So you were responsible for project management over what period of years approximately?
From around 98, 99 through 2006.
And did you take assume your current responsibilities then in 2006?
In 2006, my shift from project management building assets moved to more the business side of the Marine Division. In my early assignments, I was just primarily focused on our cruise business, which was a growing part of our portfolio. And over the years, up until now, that's expanded to be responsible for maritime operations and terminal maritime security.
Going back to the period where you were responsible for the port's assets, were you involved in redevelopment of those assets?
Absolutely.
Can you give us an overview of what assets you were responsible for redeveloping?
Sure. Some of my early assignments in project management were at Fisherman's Terminal for the redevelopment of the seawalls and the floating assets at the facility, inclusive of the electrical distribution system, the land side that supported both the buildings and the waterside features of that facility. I was also involved on the team that redeveloped Terminal 18 as a container facility. I was involved in the project management role and leading the effort of the T25 Terminal 30 redevelopment, in which we combined two previous marine terminals into one container terminal. I was involved as the lead project manager for the redevelopment of Terminal 46 for Hanjin Terminals, which was an extensive redevelopment of 88 acres, reconditioning the pier to hold larger heavy cranes, and the delivery and commissioning of the cranes for the customer. I was also involved with the redevelopment of the end of Pier 91 as a cruise terminal, and that it was a decision made that the cruise facility we had at Terminal 30 was needed to be relocated based on growing needs in the container business. And so a decision was made to look at options within the harbor. Full environmental review was done, and it was determined that Pier 91 could serve as a cruise facility. So I was involved in the delivery of the design and the construction package for Terminal 91 to commence with construction. And at the time, just shortly after construction started on the new passenger terminal on the end of Pier 91, which is there today, I moved from project management into leadership role of the business side for Cruise.
So, and did your title then become director of Cruise and Maritime Operations?
No, my title then was a manager of Cruise and Industrial Properties, I believe. Yeah.
Was there a change in duties when the title changed?
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's talk about your first title and what you did then, at which you moved to the business side.
Well, I was responsible for growing the cruise business. Basically, I am in a customer position internal to the port's teams, the project management group that was building the cruise terminal. I was really their customer from inside, and I worked directly with the cruise lines that were to be served there. As an example, I negotiated a long-term berthing agreement with Carnival Corporation for 10 years of guaranteed business at Terminal 91, which was inclusive of around five ships in order for them to achieve the passenger guarantees, which really drives the revenue to the Port of Seattle.
And then when did you broaden your responsibilities to and take on your job as Director of Cruise and Maritime Ops?
Around July of 2011, an internal reorganization basically moved the assignments of security responsibility and operations as a whole, everything other than container lease facilities. My counterpart managed the lease agreements for the Port of Seattle for the terminals that were operated through a leasehold.
So to use some of the terms that we've heard in this hearing, are you basically then responsible for all of the non-containerized terminal marine facility operations that aren't subject to leaseholds?
That's a fairly accurate statement, especially with the focus on the water side. There are some industrial properties that were still managed under the leasing group.
Okay. And the port was in the news yesterday with a new agreement regarding a cruise facility at Pier 66. Were you involved in that?
Very extensively.
And just give us an overview of what you did there and what happened.
Well, Norwegian Cruise Lines was our first cruise customer that made the decision to begin home porting in Seattle. That happened in year 2000. Our business prior to a decision by a major cruise line was very spotty in regards to serving the cruise industry. But it went back many, many years. I often show a photograph of a picture of my wife and my son, who is now 33 years old when he was 2.5 years old, standing on the dock at Terminal 25, which was a cargo facility at that time. And we used to entertain different calls from different cruise lines that would want to come into Seattle on their way to Vancouver. Because Vancouver had primarily all the home port business in the early years. As the market grew, the demand grew in Alaska for Alaska cruising. Several of the brands came to Seattle and said, you know, we'd be interested in doing more business in Seattle. Norwegian was the first. They dedicated two ships to the Pier 66 facility, which was built under a multi-purpose approach. Started out to be inclusive of some fish processing, a restaurant, conference center. It was really the regentrification of an eyesore on the waterfront, and the port was very engaged in accomplishing that goal. The area of the building that was identified as a potential cruise terminal then was redeveloped for Norwegian's commitment to home port out of Pier 66. In 1999, we had 6 calls. This year, we have 192 calls. We serve 7 major cruise brands, and this year, we have 11 different cruise ships. The economic value that this industry has brought to our region is significant. And back to your question regarding the deal that happened this week, We settled on an agreement with Norwegian Cruise Lines that they're going to reinvest money into the facility that they've home ported out of since 2000. They've committed to 15 years of service, serving as a home port out of the facility, and they've guaranteed us 276,000 passengers starting in year 2017. This means a lot to the local economy.
I want to go back to the photograph you mentioned of your son. So that was 30-plus years ago?
Well, it wasn't 30-plus years ago. I've only been at the port 30 years. And So it was he was still holding your hand when you went out got out of the car. So I can't remember exactly how old he was, but it was an example of the early years where cruise ships would come to Seattle, and we'd try to find a facility for them to allow their passengers to get off, bring buses to the terminal, take them through the city for the day, and then leave in the afternoon. At that time, there was no near security requirements as there are today. So it was fairly easy to do at any one of our facilities.
So in those long ago days, were the cruise ships mooring at cargo terminals?
Yes.
And did that ever change?
What do you mean change? Did it? Any time we had a berth available that could accommodate them and there was another committed activity scheduled, as an example, cruise ships would berth at Terminal 91 when we didn't have a cruise passenger terminal. At times we put a tent up to handle the weather conditions for the passengers. Sometimes we'd use a chill facility that may not have been occupied to process passengers through. But several different facilities were used for cruise terminals.
So you were involved as the project manager in permitting or developing the current cruise facility at T91?
Yes.
When you went in and got the approvals for that, what was your understanding? Were you asking for approval from the city to moor the cruise ships there or asking for permission from the city to build the passenger terminal?
So my direct involvement was supported by our permitting group. We knew that there was going to be a requirement under the review to address the passenger terminal. The difference of the earlier years where I mentioned that we weren't a home port, but when you're in the business of home porting ships in your harbor to support the cruise industry, that's basically a turnaround ship. And by law, foreign flag vessels that depart from the United States cruise terminal, they need to return to the same cruise terminal. That's part of the Passenger Vessel Service Act. And there's a host of security requirements, obviously, since 9/11 that are in place today. I think that all attributes to the identification of a passenger terminal. The berth itself, the depth of water, the physical length of the berth, all that was already in place and would accommodate the needs of the vessel.
We've heard the word home port many times in this hearing. Does that word have a different meaning for different maritime industries?
It does. As an example, I just mentioned, in the cruise industry, it's a common used term, home porting versus port of call. A port of call vessel comes to your dock for the day. The passengers embarked at a different port, arrived in your city, spend the day in your city, do excursions, they get back on the ship and leave. In a home porting operation, which is the majority of our business, I think we had 3 or 4 port of calls last year. In a home porting operation, the passengers are leaving the ship in the morning. They've just finished their 7-day cruise to Alaska, and that the ship is cleared through customs around 10:30, 11 o'clock. The ship is cleaned, and the new set of passengers start their embarkation. So that process repeats itself each week.
So that's what it means for the cruise industry. What does home port mean for the fishing industry?
The fishing industry is a little different. It's not tied to any regulations or laws or security. You kind of think of it as you're in a business in the maritime industry and you need a safe harbor, a safe place to come that you call home. A lot of the crews that work on the various vessels at Terminal 91 live in the greater Seattle communities in Tacoma. So home porting means really coming home after spending several months at times out fishing in the seas. You come back, you make sure that your vessel's ready for the next excursion. You do various minor repairs. If you need some major repair on your hull or something like that, you'll schedule it at a shipyard. But the activity that happens in the vessels under the crew in the fishing industry for home porting, it's like if you think, put it really simple, even in driving your car, if you go off on a vacation and you come back, you're going to check that car and do something to it before you leave again. I don't want to oversimplify it, but really home porting means coming home to the place you call home, and then often the vessel is just tied up and laid berthed until the next time it leaves.
You talked about the importance of the cruise ship industry economically to the city. What kind of importance does the fishing industry homeport business have?
Significant in regards to the number of jobs. I don't have the numbers here, but we can provide that for you. the fishing industry kind of is the one industry that a lot of the community doesn't realize, unless you're engaged in maritime, how important it is for this area of the Northwest, especially at Terminal 91 and at Fisherman's Terminal. The boats at Fisherman's Terminal are smaller. A lot of them are independently owned. And the larger ships, the processors and the trawlers and that, are at Terminal 91, owned by larger companies.
How familiar are you with moorage and operations at Terminal 5?
Terminal 5 was built for a specific customer at a time when we redeveloped it back in 1999. APL was our customer tenant at Terminal 46 at that time, and they needed to expand their operation. So through some collective discussions, agreements, and negotiations, money was invested into a facility at Terminal 5 to meet their needs, another marine cargo facility. And at that time, they wanted to make sure that there was enough space to serve two vessels at the same time for offloading and loading of containerized equipment. They also had intentions and plans to serve other maritime needs at the facility. For instance, break bulk. Westwood Shipping was served out of there for a number of years.
And who is Westwood Shipping?
They're another shipping company that moves things non-containerized.
Okay. And so was Westwood then accommodated after the redevelopment of Terminal 5?
Yes.
And what kind of break bulk did they ship?
Oh, a variety of things. Sometimes the type of perishable goods that would need to be put into a dry storage facility. There's a transit shed that was part of the facility improvements that were done that would allow things that needed to be out of the weather, different products, whether they were, you know, dry products, construction products, steel products, equipment, a variety of things that were non-containerized.
Did the fishing industry use Terminal 5 after its redevelopment into primarily a container terminal?
One of the customers that Eagle Marine was the terminal operator for APL at T5, and they had one customer that would offload fish product there and also lay up their fishing vessel at the south end of the facility. The south end of the facility, it shoals up, meaning the water is not as deep as it needs to be for a larger ship, and so it was a berthing opportunity or location for their customer to use that part of the facility.
Can you give us one or more examples of ships being at Terminal 5 for other reasons other than container or break bulk cargo, lay berthing, repairs, anything of that sort?
Well, the example that's been expressed earlier today in regards to the recent direction from the U.S. Coast Guard on the Hanjin Copenhagen was a mandate that came down from the captain of the port in that they could not leave the harbor until that repair was done. And so when the captain of the port contacted the Port of Seattle on where were there possible locations that could serve that particular repair activity, Terminal 5 was identified by the Coast Guard as a desirable location to locate that ship. The ship was not able to move under its own propulsion, so there was tugs that moved it from 46, where it had just been offloaded, over to Terminal 5. And then a special crew was flown in, I believe from Texas, to do this highly specialized repair on the propeller shaft tubes. All of it was done underwater. It was done over the series of 3 or 4 days, and then the Coast Guard gave them their certification, approval to leave.
Can you give us examples of other kinds of sort of out of the ordinary repair activities taking place at port marine facilities?
Well, one that comes to mind that was quite interesting for folks that are interested in maritime, it was quite irritating for folks that would rather have a clear, unencumbered view of the water, but the variety of interest was unique to a repair that was done at Pier 66. In the off-season, that is always considered to be a deep water berth for large vessels that has adequate fendering, adequate mooring cleats, a concrete dock that can hold heavy loads, hold cranes that can then load things on and off vessels. In this particular example, it was the, I think it was called the Polar Explorer. It was an oil tanker that needed to have a repair done that required the vessel to be ballasted down in the front end, the bow, and so that the stern then could come up out of the water and both of the propellers be completely exposed. They then set up scaffolding in and around that part of the physical characteristics of the vessel and replaced the seal bearings in and around the propeller. This activity took a little over a week, and it was much less expensive than putting the vessel into a dry dock facility, and it was fully reviewed and approved by the U.S. Coast Guard and closely monitored when the activity was performed, and a very satisfied customer that was served at that facility.
And how long ago did that happen?
I believe that was in 2008. It was after I was in the position that I'm in today as managing the cruise business.
So you referred to the off-season at Pier 66 and things that different activities taking place in the on and the off-season. Can you explain that a little bit, please?
Our cruise season runs from usually the first week in May through the end of September. I always think that if we could just get the weather to cooperate, we'd even do better in the cruise business. But there's something about being on a cruise ship in October or November when there's a lot of fog. You don't see the beauty of this part of the world. But in the off-season, a lot of other types of activity occurs at Pier 66 in regards to vessel moorage, lay-berth moorage, construction, derrick moorage, positioning of vessels that may be waiting for a date at the shipyard to go into dry dock. Fishing fleets sometime will moor there. We've had construction barges moor there. The Washington State Department of Transportation, we had an agreement with them for a period of time where they were positioning their pontoons for one of the bridge projects. They would come from the manufacturer, I think it was down in Aberdeen. They'd float them up. They'd stage them at Pier 66, and then they would move them sequentially when the construction project was ready. So a variety of activities in the off-season.
Is there a distinction in your mind in the maritime industry between provisions and cargo?
Not really. When I think of provisions, the first thing that comes to mind is provisions for a cruise ship, which is significant. A cruise ship on a turn once a week, they'll put on over 500 pallets of goods, which include everything from strawberries to medical supplies to equipment, consumables, and even product that they may be selling to the passengers. So provisioning in regards to a cruise ship is much different than provisioning, say, for a vessel that's out at anchor and the customer that's serving that provisioning comes alongside at the dock, loads groceries and supplies for a small crew, takes it out to the ship on anchor, and provides them that delivery. So provisionings and cargo, to me, is very similar. And when you think about the variety of provisioning that occurs.
What's your familiarity with vessels connected to the oil industry that have moored in the past in the city of Seattle?
Well, it's not been my priority business focus, obviously, but it's a fascinating industry that seems to be getting a lot of attention lately. But the first time I really became familiar with it was a few years ago when some of the same rigs that are being discussed in this particular issue, on, in regards to this particular issue, was here in Seattle. They were preparing for a similar exploration, to my knowledge, up in Alaska, and they had scheduled time to do some repairs and retrofitting at bigger shipyard. At that time, the support fleet that was serving that particular program, they needed various berthing locations in Seattle. And we were able to provide labor facilities for them as they were waiting for the rigs to be repaired at 91. And I don't recall exactly all the places we were able to serve them, but this included any type of vessel from a floating barge that needed to be moved by a tug to a icebreaker class vessel that was actually specifically designed to tow the type of rigs that were here in Seattle. I remember it got a lot of attention because of the uniqueness of the rigs in the harbor, and it was very positive at that time.
In your role, or your various roles in charge of managing assets and developing projects and overseeing the port's non-containerized cargo mortgage facilities, has the city ever before this case raised any issue that you're aware of with regard to how the port was mooring vessels?
Not to my knowledge, and having worked with the city in a number of different situations over the years, back when DCLU was the department, not DPD, we had a very positive relationship in regards to looking at development and sitting down together and sorting out all the details on construction elements, design elements, physical location of the piers, if we were expanding piers. It seems to be a lot different, and I actually find this whole thing a bit troubling, to be honest with you. It's important, the relationship between the Port of Seattle and the City of Seattle. The port really serves a primary function to be the connection between land and sea. And Seattle's been built around the waterfront and the maritime activity. And, you know, having committed most of my adult life to public servant and in the roles that I played for the port, I do find it troubling that it seems to be not as harmonious as it used to be in regards to how we manage facilities, how we develop facilities, how we look at the permitted uses for facilities. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, Pat, but that's kind of the way I feel about this particular situation.
So to go back to the specific question, has there ever been an issue about the port's moorage to your knowledge and understanding?
Not to my knowledge. It was always assumed that when you're building a port facility, it has a water-facing element, that there would be vessels that would utilize that public asset.
What is the port's understanding of its responsibilities as a public port?
Well, first of all, we under the FMC rules, we can't discriminate. We can't show favoritism. If someone needs a place to berth at a public facility with a vessel of any kind, whether it's a vessel that doesn't have a propulsion system, but it has a U.S. Coast Guard number, as an example, a barge, flat deck barge, that might need a place to lay berth, and we have a facility that can accommodate that. We get an inquiry, and they enter into a berthing agreement that basically spells out the laws, the rules and regulations, we entertain that use. So it's very clear to me that as a port authority, you have obligations when you're managing the public's assets to allow use of different vessel types that need a place to secure their vessel so that that connection can be made from the sea to the land.
Thank you. That's all I have.
I am going to suggest that we recess for lunch right now. Come back at, say, 10 after 1. Hopefully that your witnesses since they're arriving right around then. Is that correct?
They are. I think it would probably be a good idea to finish up Mr.
All right.
Love, but I just don't see
if you,
it's reasonable otherwise.
Okay.
So I can, you know, the people that I can get in touch with, I'll tell them to bring a book. I did say to them, I didn't know how it was quite going to end.
All right. Okay. Well, then.
If we can finish Mr. Love and do that.
Okay.
That would work well.
That is my preference. You're not constrained by their schedule. So, okay. So why don't we come back at 10 after 1, and we'll continue on with questions for Mr. McLaughlin at that point, and then move on to DPD's two witnesses. Is it?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Very good.